James, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm very well, guys. How about yourself?
Excellent. You're in such a unique position, and auto racing's so unique because part of being not only do you have to be a great driver, you really got to be a great salesman in essence to get a ride and such, and it can be frustrating because I think you're proof that sometimes the best drivers aren't getting a ride. How has this season been for you? Not being full time, at this time last year, you probably never would have thought that was a reality.
Yeah, I know for sure. I mean, this sport's a little bit unique in that sense, and Jackie Stewart, a multiple-time Formula One champion, famously said that, in motorsports, you got to be 80% businessman, 20% racing driver. And that's very true. Yeah, it still holds true today. It's an expensive sport to be a part of, and you need those corporate partners to get you on track. And with, my team last year deciding to not honor the contract that we had for 2020, it put us in a difficult spot, and we kind of went back to looking for our own sponsors again, and luckily we found a great company in Genesis that we were able to put together a three-race deal with that concluded with last Sunday's Indy 500. But definitely a different year for us, just having a handful of races, and have been lucky enough to have the opportunity to work with NBC and NBC Sports Network on the broadcast side for the remaining races. So that's been another, kind of fun thing to get to do this year. Look, man, 2020 has been a weird year for everybody. It was going to be a weird year for me anyway, so it's actually probably good timing that it happened now.
James, how do you stay sharp as a driver when you're not in those cars most weekends?
It's definitely a challenge, competing with the full-time guys that have had obviously a lot more mileage this year. But you kind of just have to rely on experience. I'm in my 10th season now in the IndyCar series, and especially at a place like Indianapolis, we have a lot more practice there than we do, at any other race weekend. So that one's a little bit easier to kind of get on top of quickly. But, the first race of the season in Texas and the one after at Indy GP, it was definitely a challenge, to try to keep up. You work with, simulators as much as you can. I'm obviously still training as if I was, full-time and in the car all season. You just got to be as prepared as you can in those ways, working with your engineers, with the engineering briefings ahead of time, make sure, from an approach to the weekend from a setup wise, you're up to speed. So there is a lot to go into it, but at the same time, it's always better to have more race laps, and those guys definitely have a bit of an advantage.
James Hinchcliffe joins us. James, a lot of open-wheel drivers jump back into karts when the IndyCar and the F1 seasons were delayed. When was the last time you were in a kart?
Yeah, I did some karting back in, I guess it was probably May, when everything kind of started to loosely open back up here in Indiana. A couple buddies and I got some go-karts together, and we went running around, and it was awesome. I mean, I haven't raced competitively in a kart since 2013, but we often try and do track days and get out there, and it's a great way to stay sharp for sure.
Now, back in 2015, you almost died. It was a very scary thing. Obviously more scary for you than for me for sure. But are there any lingering effects for you? And when you went back to the Brickyard, how was that? Was there a mental mountain for you to get over it all?
So the first part of the question is no. I'm incredibly lucky that for how serious my injuries were, and how long the recovery was, I really don't have any real lasting side effects. I got some cool scars, but that's about it. When we went back to Indy the following year, honestly, I was so far removed from it at that point that I didn't even think twice about getting back in the car there. I made a very conscious decision early on in my rehab to not associate any of what I was going through with a race car or a racetrack in particular, and because of the injury and because of the concussion I had, I don't actually remember the accident itself. And I think that really helped me not have to get over those sort of mental barriers too aggressively. I was able to show up like it was any other May and get on with the job, and we ended up actually qualifying first for that race that year. So it showed that, we were fully ready to get back behind the wheel.
What's the difference between a qualifying setup and a race setup at the 500?
Well, in qualifying, you want to take as much downforce off the car as possible because downforce equals drag. And drag slows you down over a long 2.5-mile lap there. And so it becomes a balancing act. You want to keep just enough downforce on the car to keep the thing from sliding, keep it from spinning out over four laps, but as much off as you can get to get those straight line speeds a little bit higher. Where in race trim, you really want to put on a bunch of downforce. You know you're going to be running on old tires. You're going to be running in dirty air behind other cars and traffic at certain points. So the car in race trim has definitely got a little bit more of a safer setup on it, a little bit easier to drive. Where qualifying, it's really hanging out on the edge, absolute limit of adhesion. And it's, qualifying at Indy's four laps, 10 miles, and it's one of the craziest, scariest, but most exhilarating things that we do all year.
James Hinchcliffe joins us on Edmonton Sports Leader TSN 1260. And, you know, James, for you to – how has broadcasting maybe changed anything or had you view racing differently from that vantage point?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting thing to get to do while you're still sort of an active driver because, you know, I'll go back and I'll watch all the races, you know, that we do throughout the years. Usually on Monday or Tuesday, most guys will rewatch the broadcast and just rewatch the race. And it's kind of like watching tape in hockey or football or whatever. But when you're actually part of the broadcast, you realize that there's so much more that you know is going on that they just don't have the opportunity to get across on the broadcast. So when you come home and watch it, you're just seeing what they put on TV. But when you're working on it, you see a lot of things behind the scenes. And it's interesting to get more perspectives of different drivers and races and how they went and why so-and-so ended up in this position and what happened on the pit stop with this driver that maybe didn't get covered on the broadcast because something else was happening. So you end up getting a more complete picture of the race itself, how it played out, how certain drivers ended up in certain positions. And, you know, it's all just good information to kind of have in the mental data bank for when you get back in the car, you know, what worked, what didn't, what gave guys an edge, what essentially put people in a place to win a race or get a good result that just, like I said, maybe wasn't covered on the broadcast.
James Hinchcliffe joins us. James, this as a race driver, I think you probably know, because a lot of people that maybe aren't motorheads, they look and say, well, it's hard to analyze which drivers are the best because, you know, in some Formula One or you know, even in NASCAR, not as much because it's the same vehicles. But, in some of the open wheel, they feel like the car maybe, you know, has more of a difference. I'm sure as a driver, that probably makes you cringe a little bit because it's an extremely difficult thing to do. So how do you analyze other drivers? Who do you think are some of the more underrated drivers, in your opinion, and what makes them that?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And I think every driver understands that, you know, motor racing is unique. We do have this, you know, mechanical element that has to be operating right. But I think what people also sometimes don't realize is racing is often looked at as an individual sport in the same way that, say, golf or tennis is. But the fact of the matter is it's the epitome of a team sport. It takes 20 to 25 people to get an Indy car up and running on a race weekend. You need five engineers standing on the stand, making all the right decisions on strategy and setup. You need six mechanics over the wall that are doing your pit stops. Any one of those people doesn't do their job above and beyond the driver. You're not going to win on Sunday when you have competition as fierce as we do in the IndyCar series. So it really is a team sport. And so when you look at IndyCar racing, certainly compared to Formula One, but even actually compared to NASCAR, our cars are a lot more spec than people realize. And so while there absolutely is a difference between teams and some teams operate at a higher level with bigger budgets and are going to have an advantage compared to others, we actually have more spec components than pretty much every other professional racing series. And so the driver is a bigger part of it. And so, yeah, you look for drivers that are on sort of lesser funded teams that are still pulling out good results, which is something you can actually do in IndyCar. Whereas, you know, if you're in F1 and you're not in one of the top two teams, you're not finishing in the top three. It's just not going to happen. NASCAR, there's maybe five teams. And if you're past that, you're probably not going to have a chance of winning a race. Literally everybody that starts an IndyCar race has a legitimate shot at winning it just because of the format of the racing, how competitive it is. So when you talk about guys that are maybe a bit underrated, you know, obviously Santino Ferrucci is a second-year driver. He's been doing a really good job with a team that's, you know, it's won races, but it's always kind of known as one of the smaller budgets in the sport. He's doing a great job. His teammate Alex Palou is a rookie, and has shown a lot of pace, at various races this year. But the fact of the matter is, because it's so even, you see a lot of drivers performing and they're getting the praise they deserve. You know, there's not a lot of underrated guys. I think IndyCar does a great job of showcasing the talent of the driver, and people see that.
2020 has been a hell of a year for everyone. I'm sure for you, you'd like to get to 2021. And what does that look like for you as far as getting back in the car?
For sure, the goal is to be back full time. And, like I said, we've had a tremendous partnership with Genesis this year and Andretti Autosport, and a team I raced for 3 years in the past. And it's so nice to kind of come back. And we've been working behind the scenes very hard on trying to put together our 2021 program and beyond. And, I'm definitely cautiously optimistic we can be back full time. We had some good results, but we, more importantly, just kind of forged some really good partnerships, proved to the team that, we're still quick and can bring value from an engineering side as well as the commercial side. And so, yeah, behind the scenes, like I said, we've been working hard on that, and certainly don't have anything to announce quite yet, but cautiously optimistic we'll have something in the not too distant future.
Can you kind of maybe take us a little bit behind the scenes on how that works, James, just, to get a ride? And how, when you had a contract, like, was there legal ramifications? Was there ever any consideration, because you had a contract to be in a vehicle this year. How can it just, I guess, kind of evaporate?
It really can't. So there were legal ramifications, absolutely. And it was ugly and unfortunate. I think it was handled very poorly overall, but that's in the past, and it's run its course, it's played out how it was going to, and unfortunately, just because of the timing of it all, it didn't leave me with the opportunity to seek out another ride. If it had happened a year ago in August, let's say, I had teams calling me at that point offering me a ride, but I said no, I have a contract I've got to honor. They decided in November to not honor it, and by that point all the seats are gone. And so how it works is, certain teams have sponsorship existing and they have seats that they can fund. In other cases, a driver might have a personal sponsor that supported them for a while that they can bring and add to the mix. At the end of the day, there's a number that it costs to go IndyCar racing, and whether that's coming from sponsorship money that the team has already, sponsorship money that the driver has attached to them, you just have to pool it all together and find an open seat. And that's the other big challenge. If you look at other sports that have, 600, 800, 1,000 players in the league, we have about 23 or 24 full-time seats in the IndyCar series. So a lot of it is not even just having the sponsorship lined up. It's physically having the seat being open, and the opportunity to get into a seat. So luckily, at the end of 2020, it's actually a pretty big contract cycle. There's a lot of drivers' deals are up at the end of 2020. So there will be some opportunities and some openings. And, we've just got to be smart about what we've got to offer and making sure that we're talking to all the right people and trying to put ourselves in a position to get one of those seats.
And, James, you've raced a lot of different vehicles. Is one, your clear favorite?
Honestly, for me, it's still an IndyCar, and I've been really fortunate. I've got to do some cool sports car stuff and, racing the Aussie V8 series over in Australia, which is a wicked series, really fun car to drive. But there's just something about the raw power, the downforce, the speed of an IndyCar that's really tough to match, and as a kid, I grew up just loving IndyCar racing, going to the race in Toronto, and it's always kind of been my dream. And to be here doing it, 10 years in is incredible, and I'm so lucky to do it. But yeah, for me, it's strapping into an IndyCar. That's the best place to be sitting.
And how has Indy, from an insider's perspective, you just look over the last 7 or 8 years, what's been, in your eyes, the biggest and best changes for IndyCar?
Well, I mean, certainly the introduction of the Universal Aero Kit at the start of 2018, I think, has really helped the racing. From 2015 through 2017, for those three seasons, Honda had not only the engines, but each manufacturer built their own bodywork. So Honda had their engine and their bodywork. Chevrolet had their engine and their bodywork. And there was a much bigger separation. It kind of goes to what we've been talking about with Formula One or NASCAR. That was one fewer spec part. And 1 year, one manufacturer would really nail it, and 1 year, the next manufacturer might nail it. And there was always a bit of a gap between the two. So in 2018, they reintroduced universal bodywork across all the cars. So literally the only difference between any cars on the grid is the engine in the back, and you've got one of two choices. So half the field's on one, half's on the other. And it really does make it the most even playing ground in sort of top-level motorsports. So for me, I think the move back to that was huge. And then obviously at the start of 2020, adding the aero screen, first time in open-wheel history, we've really had a halo structure with a proper aero screen designed for driver safety. And, you know, it's really kind of the leading edge of that side of driver safety. They've had halo on Formula cars over in Europe for a while, but this is really that next step. And I think that it's going to be industry standard here before too long across all open wheel cars.
James, thanks so much for taking the time today, and congratulations getting back on the track. And hopefully we look forward to your announcement when you can announce that you've got a ride for 2021 full time.
Yeah, fingers crossed, guys. Looking forward to it. But thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.